Brother, if you've ever studied the subject of prophecy very much, then you're probably at least a little familiar with the books of Revelation and the book of Daniel. Now, you're probably also familiar with the fact that both of these books describe a political system it refers to as the beast. It's a series of, you might say, world-dominating empires that would, dominate the world at various stages in history, and would particularly be the dominant force in the world at the end time, just right before the return of Christ. In fact, the book of Daniel in particular contains two chapters that describe, four different empires that are a part of this beast system. And it also tells us that the fourth empire that it describes there is associated with the end time beast, this beast power that's going to dominate the world right before the return of Christ. Now, if you study the book of Daniel, the Bible directly tells us who those first three empires are. We really don't have to guess or speculate. It just identifies them for us. Now, when it comes to the fourth empire that it associates with the end time beast, it doesn't directly tell us who that power is. However, it does give us some clues that we can work with to figure out who it is. Now, the most common speculation that you've probably heard, I know I have all of my life, is that this fourth empire is a resurrection of the Roman Empire. However, we're going to take a closer look at that today. Because as we're going to see, the Bible doesn't specifically define for us, who this fourth empire is. It does give us some biblical criteria to look at. But if we honestly and objectively look at that criteria and then compare it to what we know about the Roman Empire, there are some significant disconnects here. So what we're going to do today is take a closer look at this and see if we've come to the right conclusion in assuming that that fourth empire is the Roman Empire, or is there some other empire that we should be looking to come upon the scene before the return of Christ? So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's a fresh look at the end time beast. Again, a fresh look at the end time beast. Because we're going to look at this, the general subject of the beast here, but our focus is going to be on what is the end time beast? Who is this fourth kingdom that the book of Daniel talks about and associates with the end time beast? Because we're going to kind of challenge some common assumptions here today. So I ask that you practice Proverbs 18:13 as we go through this. That's the verse that tells us that he who answers a matter before he hears it is a fool. So I ask that you actually hear the matter, hear the evidence out, and see if this makes sense for you. So let's start off with turning over to Revelation 17. It's Revelation 17. Now, again, if you've studied the book of Revelation at all, you're probably familiar with the fact that Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 both refer to the beast. But now in Church of God history, at least in my lifetime, the Revelation 17 and 13 are oftentimes interpreted very differently. We tend to interpret Revelation 13 as, speaking more broadly about, these resurrections of the beast power throughout time. We tend to look at Revelation 17 and isolate that to being only about the Roman Empire. But let's re-examine the assumptions we've made here. So let's start in Revelation 17 in verse 1. It says, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were drunk with the wine of her fornication.' So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with golden precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of the abominations and filthiness of her fornications. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement." Now again, if you've been in the Church of God for any length of time, you're probably familiar with the fact that we typically tend to take this section of Scripture and apply this exclusively to Catholicism. to either just the Catholic Church in general or the Catholic Church and then all the, the Protestant breakoff groups that, that they broke away from the Catholic Church over time. However, again, I want you to just stop and take a step back and look objectively at this. Now, I won't take the time to turn to all of the scriptures that match this in the Old Testament. But if you do a study on the subject, what you'll see is that the imagery of harlotry, using harlotry as a symbolic reference, is something that is applied to basically idolatrous pagan worship in general. It's not exclusive to, Catholicism or the Catholic Church and such. In fact, this imagery is used all throughout the New Testament, through the Old Testament, many times again just to the worship of pagan gods or, of pagan religions. It's more of a more generic reference. In fact, if you'd like to look at all the scriptures with that, on my website, I have a paper entitled The Beast of Revelation. Now, it covers a lot more detail than what we're going to have time to cover today. And again, if you're watching the sermon on YouTube, just look below this video. There's a link there. It gives you the URL to my website. It's searchingthescriptures.org. You can just click on that link. It'll take you straight there. And again, that study paper will give you a list of scriptures, that illustrate in, throughout the Old Testament, God very often uses, again, this analogy of harlotry as, again, more of a generic reference to pagan false religion, the worship of pagan gods and such. So again, when you're looking at terms of false religion, yes, Catholicism and all the breakoff groups that came from it would fit into that description, but let's think a little more broadly of how the Bible uses the term and not just pigeonhole it to one thing. Because we're going to notice as we start reading the rest of this chapter, we're going to see a serious disconnect, with our oftentimes speculation that this is only referring to Catholicism and the Roman Empire. So let's continue reading here in verse 7. It says, "But the angel said to me, 'Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast that carries her, which has seven heads and ten horns. And the beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is the mind which has wisdom, and the seven heads and the seven mountains which are where the woman sits.'" Now notice in particular verse 10. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time." Now think about verse 10 in the context in which we have right on the page. Now the reason I mention that is if we just read the book of Revelation for what it actually says, this is a revelation that an angel is giving to the Apostle John in the first century. That's the context that we can take right off the page. Now, the reason I say that is if you made the statement to John in the first century, five have fallen, one has not yet come, how would John interpret that statement? John would interpret that statement as five of these have fallen prior to me, one exists now, and one's going to be in the future. When the one that would exist now, from John's point of view, is the Roman Empire that was in power during his lifetime. And five of them would have fallen prior to him. And then there would be another one coming after him. That would mean that the seventh one, the one that we would associate with the end time beast, wouldn't be Rome. That's how that would be interpreted. Now, if you've been in the Church of God for many years, like I have, oftentimes that verse is very, you might say, creatively interpreted. And the reason I say that is because it's oftentimes fully taken out of the context in which it's written here, and it's assumed that this must be written to be interpreted from a 20th century perspective, and the one that is would be Mussolini, from a World War II perspective. Now, again, that's a very creative way to interpret this verse, but it isn't what's written on the page. What's written on the page is that it's an angel talking to the Apostle John in the first century. So again, let's just consider interpreting it exactly like it's written, that it was John who was receiving this, and how would John understand that statement? John would understand it as five or prior to him. One is the current, is the Roman Empire that John was experiencing in his lifetime, and then there's another kingdom going to come after him. That's how John would understand it. So let's just consider it from John's perspective, because again, we don't have to do any mental gymnastics or any creative interpretation to come up with that. We just read it like it's stated to John, which the Bible says it is. So let's consider that, because if that's how this is interpreted, which again is just reading what's on the page, that would mean Rome was the sixth head, not the seventh. So let's just consider that. Now let's also consider, notice here in Revelation 17 that we've just read, we have a description of a beast with seven heads and ten horns. Now, as I mentioned, in Church of God history, we typically interpret Revelation 17 or Revelation 13 completely differently, because we look at Revelation 13 as obviously referring to multiple, you know, different kingdoms throughout time, and we try to pigeonhole Revelation 17 and say, well, it's only Rome and the Catholic Church. Well, again, let's consider this consistent reference in Revelation, in the book of Revelation, of this beast with seven heads and ten horns, and consider that maybe it's telling a consistent story the whole time. Because he's Satan, as we know, he's the dragon, he's the power behind the beast, and he's what gives it its power, and he himself is referred to as with seven heads and ten horns. So turn over to Revelation 12, and we'll see that. Revelation 12, we're going to pick up in verse 3. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having seven heads and ten horns and seven diadems on his head. And his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. Now, we don't have to speculate or guess at all as to who the dragon is. Just jump down to verse 9. It'll directly tell us. So the great dragon was cast out, the serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world and cast to the earth, and the angels were cast out with him. So it's telling us that Satan himself is pictured as seven heads and ten horns. And again, we're going to see here in Revelation 13 in just a moment, it gives us that same imagery. Let's consider that the book of Revelation is just telling a consistent story. Let's also consider another context to understand the picture of the beast in all seven. Now, we're not going to cover all seven heads today. Again, the paper that's on my website that I referenced before does address all seven heads in that subject. But again, I want you to think a little more broadly. But think in terms of the narrative of the Bible itself. From the book of Genesis forward, you know, once you get to Abraham and the promises made to him, then the whole focus of the narrative of the Bible becomes about Abraham's descendants, specifically through his son Jacob, you know, who became Israel, and his 12 sons. Then the narrative of the Bible focuses on Israel, and other nations come into the story really as they interact with Israel. That's the whole focus of the narrative of the Bible. Now, what you'll see if you read the paper on my website that addresses all seven kingdoms that are being addressed here, what they have in common is they were all nations that had Israel in captivity and were dominating over Israel and trying to force false religion upon the Israelites. Because again, that's the common theme, because again, what's the narrative of the Bible? It's a story about Israel, and other nations come into the story as they interact with Israel. So now let's turn over to Revelation 13 and let's look at what's described here. And again, we're going to see a very consistent picture here with what we read in Revelation 17. We're going to have a beast with seven heads and ten horns. It's a political system that's being, you know, pictured here. There's also a false religious system that goes along with it. But it's going to be very obvious from this chapter that we're talking about a whole lot more than just Rome. Obviously, Rome is part of the picture, but it's a much bigger picture than just Rome. Let's start in Revelation 13 in verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his ten horns ten crowns, and on his head head, and on his head a blasphemous name. Now again, that same picture, seven heads, ten horns. We saw that in Revelation 17. We also saw Satan himself described the same way. In verse 2, "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority." As I mentioned, we saw before that Satan is the dragon, he's the power behind it, but notice he's described the same way. Now, a little bit later, we're going to look at Daniel 7, and we'll see here that the symbolism that's portrayed here directly matches Daniel 7. So we know that, you know, Daniel 7 is describing four different, you know, kingdoms there. You know, and obviously we're talking about a whole lot more than just the Roman Empire. So continue in verse 3. "And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshiped the dragon, who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?' And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And the authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. And he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity, and he who kills with the sword must also be killed with the sword. And here is the patience and faith of the saints." Now again, here we have this political system, you know, described here with seven heads and ten horns. Again, very consistent with Revelation 17. We also noticed in Revelation 17, you know, there was a woman described as harlotry, you know, false religion, that was riding this beast, that was basically working in conjunction with it. Now, if we read the latter half of Revelation 13, we see the exact same thing. We see a false religious system that's involved, you know, that basically partners with this political system. Now, pick up in verse 11. "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, who had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon." Now, if we just put that symbolism together, it's obvious that we're talking about a false religious system here. Because, you know, Christ is described many times in the Bible as the Lamb. It's the Lamb of God, or as our Passover Lamb. You know, we also saw that the dragon, that's imagery for Satan himself. What this is saying is, you know, this beast has the appearance of a lamb, it has the appearance of Christ, you know, and it also, but it speaks like a dragon, speaks like Satan. So obviously we're talking about a false religious system here. Now continue in verse 12. "And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth of those who dwell on it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he performs great signs so that even makes fire come down from heaven and the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which were granted to him to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast that was wounded by the sword and lived, and was granted to give breath to the image of the beast, and the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except those who have the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And here is wisdom. Let him who understands calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. The number is 666. Now, as I've mentioned in previous sermons, and there's a sermon and a study paper as well on my website that addresses the mark of the beast. But, you know, the mark of the beast, you know, we oftentimes think of that as just an end time reference, but that's really not accurate. Because if you look at how the resurrected first fruits are described in the Bible, they're described as those who rejected the mark of the beast. Now, the first fruits are obviously everyone who was called from the time of Adam and Eve in the garden all the way up to the return of Christ. All those who were called and accepted that calling and successfully endured to the end and made it into the kingdom, that's that group collectively. Well, if that group collectively is described as those who rejected the mark of the beast, the mark of the beast is not just an end time concept. Because, see, we have symbolic imagery here. When it's referring to the forehead and the head, and it's referring to, on the forehead and the hand is your thoughts and your actions. So what this is referring to here is people who are following Satan's way of life. That's those who have the mark of the beast. It's not a tattoo, it's not an implanted computer chip or a barcode or things of that nature. It's a symbolic reference to how we behave. And we can have the mark of the beast anytime that that we live in history. Doesn't really matter what time frame it was. It's a symbolic reference to referring to following Satan's way of life is basically what it's about. And those who've rejected the mark of the beast are those who are faithfully following God. But the point I want you to see here is this is a broader reference than just the end time and just the Roman Empire and the Catholic Church. This is a much broader reference going on here. Because as we're going to see when we turn over to Daniel 7 here in a moment, the imagery that we saw here, with the first part of this chapter, referring to the political system, is obviously including a compilation of the four empires that are described in the book of Daniel. We know that's much more than just the Roman Empire. There's a whole lot more going on here. I mean, yes, Rome is a part of the bigger picture of the beast here. That's what Revelation 17 told us. We know that they're part of all of this, but there's a lot more going on than that. And see, the false religious system here, again, is much more than just the Catholic Church. Again, harlotry, as I mentioned, if you follow the references in the Old Testament, it's more of a generic reference to worshiping pagan gods and following pagan religions and practices, rejecting the true God and following Satan's way. Is basically what it's getting at. It's a broader reference that you need to consider. Now again, to realize that we're obviously talking about more than just the Roman Catholicism here, turn over to Daniel chapter 7. Because as I mentioned here, the imagery that we saw in Revelation 13 there directly matches imagery that we're going to see here in Daniel 7 when it's referring to the four beasts here in a vision that was given to Daniel. Now, as we're going to see here later, Daniel 7 and Daniel 2, they're both inspired dreams that were given. Daniel 2 was given a dream given to Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel 7 is an inspired dream that is given to Daniel. Now, they both speak about, four world-dominating empires that would take place throughout history. And as we're going to see, it's talking about a whole lot more than just the Roman Empire. But what I want you to see here is as we read through Daniel 7, we're going to read through the first 8 verses here, and see that the imagery here directly matches what we read in Revelation 13. So we know Revelation 13 is including a compilation of all the empires that are described here. So let's start reading in Daniel 7 in verse 1. It says, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions in his head while on his bed, and then he wrote down the dream telling the main facts." Now again, just as a side detail, and this will make sense a little bit later as to why I'm emphasizing this. Notice here, as he just described, Daniel is receiving this vision during the reign of the Babylonian Empire. Now the reason I kind of point that out is we'll see later in chapter 5, it records when the Babylonian Empire is overthrown and the Medo-Persian Empire takes power. And chapter 7 is recorded after chapter 5, in terms of how the book is written here. But it directly tells us that he has received this vision during the Babylonian Empire. Because where we're going to see the context here when we look at the four empires is going to be very important. Because both Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar were living in Babylon during the Babylonian Empire when they received these visions. And that'll make sense a little later why I'm emphasizing that. But let's continue in verse 2. And Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And the four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, and it was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between his teeth. And they said thus to it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and there was another, like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. And the beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth, and it was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. And it was different from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up from among, before whom the 3 first horns were plucked out of its roots. And there was a horn where the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. Now, as we're going to see here, Daniel is directly told that this represents four kingdoms, or 4 kings, four empires that would reign throughout time. Now, again, we don't have to speculate or guess about that at all. All we have to do is just jump down to verse 15, and it directly tells us this. And verse 15 says, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions on my head troubled me. And I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of this. And he told me, and it made known to me the interpretation of these things. And those great beasts, which are 4 kings which arise out of the earth. You see, this directly tells us we're talking about 4 different kingdoms. So we know for sure what that interpretation is. Now we also know, again, if you look at the symbolism that's used here, obviously, Revelation 13 was including, these 4 empires, in its description. So we know Revelation 13 is talking about a whole lot more than just the Roman Empire. Now, again, if we assume the 7 heads and 10 horns is a consistent picture, because we saw it in Revelation 13, we saw it in Revelation 12 describing Satan himself, we saw the exact same thing in Revelation 17. Again, let's just consider this is a consistent picture that we're talking about here. And we don't have to get real creative with interpretations. If we just looked at Revelation 17, what did it tell us? The angel told us, when he was talking to the apostle John, in the first century, 5 have already fallen, 1 is, and 1 hasn't come yet. How would John interpret that statement? John would interpret that statement as the one that is the Roman Empire that he's experiencing. 5 were prior to him, and there's a different one coming. So let's keep that in mind. Now let's turn back over to Daniel 2. We'll see that Nebuchadnezzar was inspired a dream as well that matches this, because it's describing 4 kingdoms as well. As you know, the story here is Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, but he doesn't know what it means. And he basically issues a challenge to call kind of all the soothsayers, all the wise men of Babylon. They have to come and not only interpret his dream, they got to tell him what he dreamed, because that's his way of basically fact-checking them. And because he figures if they can tell him what the dream is, well, then there's credibility in what they give him as far as an interpretation. Because anybody, you could just make up an interpretation of the dream that he gives them, but he does this as a test. Well, then God inspires Daniel, with the answers, as to what's being revealed to him. And then Daniel comes and tells Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of the dream. But let's notice here, he's also going to describe 4 kingdoms here that are throughout time. But this is going to give us more details to understand and to identify these kingdoms. So let's start in verse 27 of Daniel 2. Again, Daniel 2, verse 27. So Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the later days. Your dream and the visions on your head, upon your bed, were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this, and he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me, because I have more wisdom than anyone living. But for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, that you may know the thoughts of your heart. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. And this great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. Its image was of fine gold. Its chest, its head, the image's head was of fine gold. Its chest and arms of silver. Its belly and thighs of bronze. Its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. And then the iron and clay and the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone was struck and the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell you the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you the power, the kingdom, power, strength, and glory. Whenever the children of men dwell, and the beasts of the field, the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand, and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So we know conclusively that the first kingdom is Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar, because it just directly tells us that. In verse 39, but after you shall rise another kingdom inferior to yours, and then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, as much as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things, like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of the potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes and feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. I notice that this directly tells us that this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw represents four kingdoms. Well, that's exactly what we saw in Daniel 7. It was four different kingdoms. But now let's try to identify who these kingdoms are. Now, we just saw that we don't have to guess what kingdom number one is. You know, the head of gold, that's Nebuchadnezzar's empire, because it just directly stated that to us. But now let's consider the context so we can identify the others, because this is a point that gets missed, that oftentimes confuses what the fourth kingdom is. But let's notice here, again, let's look at verse 37 again. It says, you, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom of power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Again, we very conclusively know that kingdom number one, that's the Babylonian Empire that Nebuchadnezzar was over. But now also just think in terms of context. He told Nebuchadnezzar, wherever men dwell, you're ruling over them. Now, obviously, we have to interpret that comment in its context, you know, because we all know, did Nebuchadnezzar rule the entire earth where every human being on the earth lived? Obviously not. There were lots of areas that he didn't have, reign over. He ruled over a region in the Middle East, is basically what took place. And we're about to look at the parameters of that. But that was the context that they understood as all the areas where men dwell. So what we're going to need to focus on is not only empires that succeeded one another, but empires that reigned that area, that was relevant to where they received it. Because as I pointed out before, Nebuchadnezzar was in Babylon, ruling over the Babylonian Empire when he received his dream. Well, as we read earlier in Daniel 7, even though again it's in chapter 7 and the Medo-Persian Empire takes over in chapter 5, if you read this, the beginning of chapter 7, it directly tells us that when Daniel had that dream, it was still during the reign of the Babylonian Empire. He's in Babylon. It's part of the Babylonian Empire when this takes place. So this is the context that both of them receive that dream in. Now, to understand this from a geographical perspective, because then again, geography, as we're going to see, is going to become important in our interpretation of these kingdoms. The Babylonian Empire, if you were to look at a modern day map to see where the city of Babylon was, it's in the country that we today call Iraq. And again, if you look at a map of the Babylonian Empire, and I highly encourage you, if you want to fact check this sermon, spend a little time on Google and look up the geographic areas that the kingdoms that we're going to talk about today actually had reign over. That's going to become very important because there's going to be some obvious facts you're going to see doing that. And you can do it in 10 minutes on Google. And again, particularly when we get to the fourth kingdom, you're going to see the logical disconnects, because once you look at the maps, it's going to scream at you. But notice here, the Babylonian Empire, and I'm going to express this in terms of modern day countries. So if you looked at a modern day map, it would make sense to you. The area that was covered by the Babylonian Empire that Nebuchadnezzar had, that included what we today call Iraq, Syria, Jordan, and Israel. Now, again, I'm not referring to the promised land in general. I'm talking about the nation of Israel that you would see labeled as Israel on a map today. It included those countries as well as what we call Western Iran, Northern Saudi Arabia, and Southern Turkey. That would basically be where the boundary lines of the Babylonian Empire would be if you labeled the countries as they are identified today. But now, so if we're going to look at the succeeding kingdoms, we need not only empires that come later in history, we need empires that are relevant to that geographical area because that's where they were. Now, the next major empire, as you might expect, and this is widely agreed upon, is the Medo-Persian Empire. About 539 BC, approximately, I don't try to get too dogmatic on exact dates, but about 539 BC, the Medo-Persian Empire conquers, the Babylonian Empire. In fact, this is recorded in the Bible. As I mentioned, the Bible just identifies these first three kingdoms for us. Just turn over to Daniel 5 and verse 30, and we'll see here where it records, where the Babylonian Empire is conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire. And that's here in Daniel 5 and verse 30. It says, "That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old." So again, not only was this the next kingdom in history and the kingdom that conquered the Babylonian empire, let's also look at this geographically. Because see, the Medo-Persian Empire included most all the territory of the Babylonian Empire. Again, there's a little bit of edges that may be different, but it's the main core area, they conquered that as well. But it was also larger. Because you're going to see, as we look through these four kingdoms, their territory gets larger and larger. But this also included all of modern-day Iran and all of modern-day Turkey, as well as what today we call Pakistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Egypt, and northeastern Libya. So you can see it geographically matches the right area. And again, the Bible just records that this is the kingdom that conquered it. We don't have to guess. The Bible just directly tells us. Now, again, if we look in history, the next kingdom that comes that actually, you know, conquers the Medo-Persian Empire is the Greco-Macedonian kingdom. Now, this is, you know, occurs approximately 330 BC. And again, the Bible makes reference to this as well. Because as we saw in Daniel 7, you know, how did it describe, you know, that third kingdom? Well, it described it with four heads. Well, we have a similar imagery used in Daniel 8. Now, Daniel 8 is a different prophecy that uses some different imagery as well. And I'm not going to get into all the details of what Daniel 8 is addressing, but I want you to notice here a direct reference. The Bible just directly tells us it's talking about Greece. It's talking about the Greco-Macedonian Empire, and it describes it similarly. So again, we can just kind of nail this down from the biblical reference, and then we'll look at the geography just in a minute here and see that matches as well. Now, notice here in Daniel 8, and we're going to pick up in verse 18. So now he was speaking with me. I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, and for the appointed time the end shall be. And the ram which you saw, having two horns, they are the kings of Medo and Persia, the Medo-Persian Empire. And verse 21, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king, it's Alexander the Great. In verse 22, and as for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its own, not with its power. So you can see here, this directly tells us it's talking about Greece, and the imagery matches exactly with how Daniel 7 describes the third kingdom. And again, not only did the Greco-Macedonian Empire, you know, conquer the Medo-Persian, but again, let's look at this from a geographical perspective. Now, the Greco-Macedonian Empire included all of the territory previously that was a part of the Medo-Persian Empire, but also modern-day Greece, Bulgaria, and southeastern Romania. So you also see another trend with this. Each of the empires is not only ruling over the main, you know, the core of what was the Babylonian Empire, they're getting larger. They're covering more and more territory. And see, here's where we get to the disconnect with our assumptions about who the fourth empire is. Because now keep in mind, the Bible doesn't directly identify the fourth empire, but it does give us a criteria to look at. Now let's turn back over to Daniel 2. And let's read verse 40. Because the Bible gives us a direct statement about a criteria that we're going to need to look for, you know, to identify this fourth kingdom. In verse 40, and the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Now that is a very key statement there. All the others. Now we know, since we've identified the first three kingdoms, they didn't all exist simultaneously. You know, they weren't, you know, in existence during the same times in history. What tended to, you know, what happened was one would go out of existence and the next one comes in, you know, and then this happens throughout history. So the only way that you can look at the fourth kingdom crushing all of the others, since, you know, the other three weren't all in existence simultaneously, it has to basically conquer all of the territory that was covered by the other three kingdoms combined. And see, here's the key of why I've looked at this geographically. You know, because I've described, as we've gone through the other kingdoms, you know, if you look at a map, if you spend 10 minutes on Google and fact check me, which I highly encourage you to do, because the facts here will scream at you if you put a little time into looking at this. Remember, the fourth kingdom, as we just read, it's got to have conquered the territory of all the others. Rome does not match that criteria. It doesn't even come close. Because if you look at the combined area of the other three kingdoms, Rome has a little less than one-third of the territory covered by all of the others. The other problem it has, it doesn't include the main territory of the original Babylonian kingdom. You know, it never ruled over the area of Babylon. It really only had kind of the far western, you know, sections of what was the Babylonian kingdom. The core of it was never over. To kind of describe for you the area the Roman Empire covered, and again, I highly encourage you, get on Google, spend 10 minutes just doing some searches, looking at the maps, you know, that way you can visually see it, and the evidence will scream at you. You won't be able to argue with it. Now, what the Roman Empire included was basically all the main territory surrounding the Mediterranean Sea. Now, when you think in terms of going east of the Mediterranean Sea, what the Roman Empire included was, again, modern-day Israel. And again, I'm not referring to the Promised Land, you know, the entire, you know, territory identified as the Promised Land by the Bible. I'm referring to the nation of Israel as it's defined on a map today. You know, they included modern-day Israel and portions of Syria and Jordan. They really didn't go much farther east than that. You know, they didn't even get all of Syria or all of Jordan, let alone Iraq, you know, what we call it today, which was where, you know, Babylon was and the main core of the Babylonian Empire. You know, in all that territory, they really only had kind of the western edge of what was considered the Babylonian kingdom. Now, there was one short period, I want to say around 116 or 117 AD, where they made a short military conquest into, you know, a little farther eastward into that territory. But if you look in history, they very quickly got pushed back by opposing armies, and they never tried to expand farther eastward at any time there. You know, so what you'll see is Rome never really, you know, held any territory east of, again, Jordan, you know, the edge of Jordan and Syria. You know, what we call today Jordan and Syria. So they didn't include the territory that was the core of the Babylonian Empire. And they certainly didn't have all of the territory covered by the three, you know, empires combined. Again, they had less than one third of it. They just simply don't match the biblical criteria is where we're at. Now, if we do look a little further in history, you know, we're going to see an empire that does match this. See, there was the Islamic Caliphate Empire. And that began in approximately 632 AD with the Rashidun Caliphate is what it was referred to. And this went on, you know, that if you consider the entire caliphate, for over 1,000 years. In fact, it culminated with the Ottoman Empire, and that officially ended in 1923. Now, think of this similar to how we look at the Greco-Macedonian Empire. The reason I mention that is, you know, the Greco-Macedonian Empire, as you know, we've recognized for years, you know, starts with Alexander the Great. In other words, one unified empire under one single leader. And then it busts up into, you know, to four different parts, and that goes on for, you know, for quite a period of history. In fact, Daniel chapter 11, you know, is pretty much a story of the Seleucid kingdom and the Ptolemaic kingdom, you know, fighting with each other throughout time. But that's all looked at, you know, prophetically as part of the Greco-Macedonian Empire, even though it was kind of broken up into fragments at times. Well, the Islamic Caliphate would be about the same, because there were times where there were, you know, different emphasis of leaders, but there was a huge region, you know, in this part of the world that was Islamic controlled there. And again, if you just Google the term Islamic Caliphate Empire, you'll see that's recognized as an empire, and you'll see the map that it covers. But here's what you'll see. It reigned over all of the areas controlled by the first three empires and also reigned over most all of northern Africa and even modern-day Spain. It had a huge area that it covered. And also, if you look in history, now notice, as I mentioned, when we started off in Revelation 17, the angel said to John, these seven heads, you know, they're seven kings, but five have fallen, one is, and one has not come yet. Now, again, as I've mentioned from the beginning of this sermon, how would John in the first century understand that statement? John would understand that as five of these empires were prior to me, they've already fallen. The one that is the Roman Empire, you know, that he was experiencing in his lifetime, and there was going to be another one that comes after that. Now, if you look at, again, just historical empires in terms of a timeline of history, yes, after the Greco-Macedonian Empire, falls, Rome is the next major empire, in power at that time, and then the Islamic Caliphate kind of happens after that. That would be the sequence of events. But again, if you think in terms of, we oftentimes say that the Roman Empire conquered the Greco-Macedonian Empire, they conquered what was left of the Greco-Macedonian Empire. Because here's just another interesting thing that a map will clarify for you. If you look at Daniel chapter 11, now that's oftentimes referred to as the Middle Eastern prophecy, because it's this long history of, it starts off at the beginning of the chapter with Alexander the Great and his empire. Then obviously he dies, and then it divides up. And then it refers to the king of the north, which most everyone recognizes as the Seleucid kingdom. And it talks about the king of the south, which is the Ptolemaic kingdom. Then now what you'll see there, though, is that when Rome finally comes in and conquers part of this area, they get most all of the Ptolemaic kingdom that they conquer. They only get a little bit of the western edge of the Seleucid kingdom. Now, just as an interesting side note, and this is addressed in the paper on my website that I mentioned. If you look at Daniel 11, most everybody, even most all Church of God sources, all agree that the vast majority of the chapter, the king of the north is the Seleucid kingdom, and the king of the south is the Ptolemaic kingdom. And this is just the history of these two kingdoms fighting with each other. But then they get right down to the end, the last few verses in that chapter. And then they decide, no, well, no, now the king of the north is the Roman Empire. And the logic they use for that, they say, well, the Roman Empire conquered the Seleucid kingdom. Now, what they conquered was the very western edge that was still surviving of the Seleucid kingdom that the Parthians had not already conquered. And they use that logic to say, well, now the king of the north is Rome. But they completely ignore the fact that the Ptolemaic kingdom was totally conquered by Rome. So if you're going to transfer the king of the north to Rome to try to get the end time beast to be Rome, how can you ignore doing the same logic with the king of the south? And now, if both of them are Rome, why are they fighting with each other? See, it just doesn't make sense. When you see logical disconnects like that, it's a massive red flag that someone has gone into the subject with a preconceived notion. They've already decided the conclusion they want to come to, and they're reverse engineering their way to arrive at that conclusion. Because if you're going to use the logic that, well, Rome conquered, a little bit of what was left of the Seleucid kingdom, therefore the king of the north transfers, how can you avoid having to do the same logic with the king of the south? Because the argument is much, much stronger with the king of the south. See, it's a reverse engineered argument. You see, what we have to do is stay consistent with logic, and also consistent with the biblical criteria. The Bible tells us that the fourth kingdom conquers all of the area of the other three. Spend 10 minutes on Google looking at maps, of where these kingdoms, the territory that they covered, and you're going to quickly see it's going to scream at you. You can't argue with it. Rome did not conquer all of the area of the other three kingdoms combined. They got less than a third of that territory. They simply don't match the criteria. The kingdom that does match that criteria is the Islamic Caliphate kingdom. What that tells us is we're looking for the end time beast. We're not looking for him to come out of Europe. We're looking for a kingdom to come out of the Middle East is what we're looking for. Because see, we also have to realize that the Bible tells us that the fourth kingdom is again associated with the end time beast. Because even though, the Islamic Caliphate Empire ended again with the Ottoman Empire, I mean, just think of the argument that's oftentimes used with the Roman Empire. We know that went out of existence years ago as well. We always look at the end time beast as being a resurrection of that fourth kingdom. And we're going to see the Bible does substantiate that idea, that the fourth kingdom would basically cease to exist for a while, and then it would come back at a later point in history. Let's just notice in Daniel 2 here that Daniel 2 connects the fourth kingdom with the end time beast, that it's in existence when Christ returns. So let's notice here in verse 34, pick up again in Daniel 2. says, "You watched while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. And then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone was struck with the image, became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." Now, as the Church of God has taught for years, this is a reference to Christ returning, you know, and conquering all of these. But notice, it's that fourth kingdom, it's the feet that are being crushed. Now, just jump down to verse 40 again, and we'll see here that this is obviously referring to the end time here. In verse 40, "And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others." Now again, remember, as I mentioned, you know, the first three kingdoms, they didn't all exist simultaneously in history. So the only way the fourth kingdom can crush all of the others, it's got to basically conquer all of the territory that all of the other kingdoms, you know, had ruled over. Again, as I mentioned, fact check me on this. Spend 10 minutes on Google. Look at the maps, you know, that these kingdoms, you know, had ruled over. And you'll very clearly see, it'll scream at you, it's undeniable. Rome does not meet that criteria because they did not cover all that territory. They had less than a third of it. But just keep reading in verse 41. "Whereas you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, and the toes of feet that were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom will be partly strong and partly fragile. And as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will be mingled with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. And it shall break in pieces and consume all the kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." See, obviously we're referring to the fact that the fourth kingdom is going to be in existence, you know, at the time of Christ's return. Because that's who he's going to defeat, the armies he's going to defeat, you know, in his return in Revelation 19. But let's realize what the way to put this together is. We know that, you know, the Islamic Caliphate Empire ended when the Ottoman Empire officially came to an end in 1923, but yet there's going to be a revival of it. Because what the Bible tells us is, again, that seventh kingdom, you know, again has a period where it goes out of existence and it pops back. You know, the seventh head there in, you know, the description in Revelation 13 and 17, you know, but it's also the fourth kingdom in Daniel. Because Daniel's just addressing kingdoms specifically relevant to the area where Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel were living. But turn now over to Revelation 17, where we started, because what I want you to see is, again, this consistent theme. Because we're going to see here, again, the final kingdom, again, has a period where it goes out of existence and then it returns. And that's consistent throughout Revelation 17, Revelation 13, and the book of Daniel. Because again, what I want you to see here, particularly as I mentioned when I started this sermon, we oftentimes interpret Revelation 17 and Revelation 13 as telling different stories. But because we look at Revelation 13, it's this compilation of everything that's included in Daniel. And then we look at Revelation 17 as, well, that's Rome and only Rome, and it's just Rome and the Catholic Church. As we're going to see here, it's telling you a consistent story. And again, if we just step back and read it in its context and interpret it as a vision given to John, the Apostle John, who lived in the first century, and not as something written to the 20th century, you know, it's like it says on the page, then we're going to see here this picture of seven heads and 10 horns. It's a very consistent story that's being told. So notice here again, in Revelation 17, let's pick up again here in verse 9. "And here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings." Again, I know I've been hammering this, but just follow this in verse 10. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. Again, just ask yourself, how would John in the first century interpret that statement? He would not interpret the one that is as Mussolini during World War II. He would interpret it as the Roman Empire that was in existence in his time. But now continue reading in verse 11. And the beast that was and is not is himself the eighth and is of the seven and is going to perdition. So notice he says there's one that was and is not, and yet there's an eighth. So in other words, the seventh one, it's going to have a period where it goes out of existence, and it's going to come back, you know, as technically the eighth, but it's of the seven. It's a revival of number seven. And this picture is consistent with Revelation 13. Let's turn over to Revelation 13, and let's read this again, because we're going to notice this same picture, that one of the heads of the beast gets mortally wounded, and then it gets healed. In other words, it was in power, it went out of existence, and it comes back. This is Revelation 13 in verse 1. Then I stood in the sand of the sea, and I saw the beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horn ten crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like a feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. As we saw earlier, you know, Satan is the dragon. And obviously, you know, the symbolism here in verse 2 totally matches what we read in Daniel 7. You know, so we realize, you know, those four kingdoms in Daniel are obviously included in what's being discussed here. But now let's notice in verse 3. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast who is able to make war with him? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue 42 months. In other words, 3.5 years. That's what we always connect with the end time. You know, with the 3.5 years of the rule of the beast, well, notice, it's the head that had a mortal wound and was healed that this applies to. That's the seventh head, you know, just like Revelation 17 said, you know, the seventh one, for it also the heck then technically has an eighth, but it's of the seven. In other words, it's the seventh one, but then it was mortally wounded and then it returns. See, it's telling you a very consistent story. And, you know, and to see that, all we have to do is, again, just read it as it's written, and notice again the Revelation 13 with the seven heads and ten horns. Revelation 12, it's speaking of Satan, but he's the power behind it. What do we see? Seven heads, ten horns. Revelation 17, what do we have? Seven heads, ten horns. It's very, very consistent. It's telling you the same story. But the same idea of, you know, a kingdom that exists and then, you know, goes out of existence and then comes back again, has basically a revival. This is the imagery, if we pay very close attention to Daniel 2, indicates a similar story as well. Now, turn back over to Daniel 2. Daniel 2. Let's notice here in verse 31. You, O king, were watching, and behold a great image. This great image was splendor, was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and clay. Notice technically you have five divisions there. You know, because, you know, the first three are just referred to as one type of metal. And then we get to the fourth and it says, well, the legs are iron, but the feet are iron and clay. But yet, the chapter only speaks of four kingdoms. But technically, you have actually five different symbolic divisions here. Because again, jump down to verse 40. It says, "In the fourth kingdom shall be as strong inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others." Again, it has to rule over all the territory of the other three combined. Rome does not do that. The Islamic Caliphate did. But now I want you to notice, you know, again, it speaks of the fourth kingdom, but then it addresses the feet. Because you notice the legs were iron, the feet are iron and clay. It's different. Because see, there's two phases to that fourth kingdom. Now continue reading in verse 41. "Whereas you saw the feet, the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. The kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of iron shall be in it. Just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And as the iron mixed with ceramic clay will mingle with the seed of men, and they will not adhere to one another, just as the iron does not mix with clay." You see, the feet, that's actually the revival of that fourth kingdom, you know, which again is the revival of the seventh kingdom. You know, head of the beast, when we're looking at it from Revelation 13 and 17's perspective. And see, that's where the ten horn imagery comes in as well. The ten horns and the ten toes match each other. Now, I won't get into a lot of detail in regards to that, but you'll see that the Bible speaks of those ten horns as being ten kings that basically give their power over there in an alliance with the beast. And again, I'm not going to engage in any wild speculation as to what exactly that means. You know, from my perspective, the Bible doesn't really tell us exactly what that's about. And I think, you know, the Church of God has too bad of a negative history of wild speculation and in that regard, so I'm not going to engage in that. I think what we can identify from history is that fourth kingdom, you know, was the Islamic Caliphate. So what we're looking for going forward, again, is not a beast power to rise out of Europe. We're looking for a beast power to rise out of the Middle East. And it will be an Islamic-dominated kingdom, is what will come about. Now, these other ten horns, that suggests, you know, the ten horns and the ten toes, the way it's described in the Bible is like this: these are separate kings, but they're in an alliance. They're together with the beast, you know, during that time. Again, that's some kind of political alliance that's taking place. You know, we'll just have to wait and see how history, you know, proves what that exactly is. But brethren, what I want you to see from this sermon is, as I mentioned from the onset of this sermon, you know, the book of Daniel identifies, you know, four major kingdoms that are part of the beast system. Again, the beast also described in the book of Revelation. Now, the first three, as I mentioned, the Bible just directly tells us who they are. You know, we don't have to guess or speculate at all. Now, the fourth one, we have to engage in some logical guessing there based upon biblical criteria, because the Bible just doesn't explicitly tell us. But as I've demonstrated today, and again, let me emphasize, I highly encourage you, spend 10 minutes on Google, look at the maps. It's going to scream at you. Because as we saw from Daniel 2 and verse 40, you know, the fourth kingdom, it crushes all of the other three. The only way it can do that is it has to conquer all of the territory of the other three. If you spend 10 minutes on Google looking at maps, it will be very, very painfully obvious to you, you know, that Rome does not match that criteria. It just simply does not. And again, if we just read Revelation 17 from the perspective as it's written, an angel talking to the Apostle John in the first century, how would John interpret the statement that five have fallen, one is, and one is not yet? John would interpret that as Rome was the sixth of the heads that, you know, was in power at his time. Well, again, if we put together the maps and history, what we come up with is the seventh head is the Islamic Caliphate. So what that tells us for our lives going forward, as we all know, we live, you know, in the end times, or, you know, close to the times described, you know, by that, and we're looking for the end time beast to rise up before the return of Christ. Well, the area, the region of the world we need to be watching is the Middle East. And again, if you'd like to go through and understand all seven heads and the whole picture together, I would encourage you to go to my website. There, I have a paper there called The Beast of Revelation. You know, and again, it covers a lot more than I've had time to go through today in a lot more detail, and it addresses all seven heads of the beast. Again, what you're going to see is the commonality they have is they're all empires that had Israel in captivity and were trying to force pagan religion upon the Israelites. Because how is the Bible written? It's a story about Israel, you know, and other nations come into the story as they interact with Israel. If you understand it from that perspective, you'll see what connects all of the kingdoms together. So, brethren, as we go forward from this Sabbath, you know, we need to always be thinking about, you know, making sure that our spiritual house is in order, as we know the end is coming. And again, whether that comes in our lifetime or not is irrelevant. Our time of judgment is now. But again, as we look for the end time beast, let's follow the biblical criteria and look at the Middle East rather than Europe.